Welcome to the Woodshop Live podcast, a bi-weekly podcast focused on the craft of woodworking. I'm Sean Walker of Simple Cove, and I'm joined today by Hui Huynh of Alabama Woodworker.
Hey.
And Guy Dunlap of Guy's Woodshop.
How are you this evening, Sean?
I'm excellent. This podcast is intended to answer questions from the woodworking community and give you some of our perspectives on how we get things done in our own shops, right or wrong. I want to also mention that we have a new Patreon account. Right now, we have one level, and we are simply asking for a small donation just to try to cover the costs of bringing you this podcast. Please visit patreon.com/woodshoplife. We sincerely hope that you give us your support. So let's get right into it. Hui, what's your first question?
All right. The first question that I have is from Ryan at rcrich85. He asks, how often do you come up with your own design for projects versus using or modifying a found plan to fit your needs? What helped the most with being able to design your own projects, books, looking at actual pieces and dissecting them? Is there any part of a project that you routinely find difficult to design? I'm in the early stages of designing a storage bed for my kids, and I'm not the biggest fan of a lot of them online. I want them to be more fine woodworking, quote unquote, which would require heavy modification of an existing plan or starting from scratch. I'm interested to hear what you guys do to evolve your designs. Well, I've done more or less all of the above. I'll say this, that when I get to a point of, I can get exhausted from designing my own piece sometimes. And what I often like to do is actually find plans or designs that are actually pretty close to what I already want, so that I don't have to figure out joinery thickness, things like the length or the standard height of, say, a buffet or whatnot. I do also look at books, and I want to say there's a really good book that a lot of woodworkers have been using. I can't think of the name of it. Maybe you guys can help
me
out.
That's helpful.
Well, it's it's a book that talks about a lot of the ergonomics behind furniture, like the standard height of a lounge chair, the standard angle of a lounge chair, the standard angle and height of or back for desk chair, those sort of things.
This just popped into my head when you were talking, that I reference all the time, and it's Rodale's Illustrated Cabinet Making is what I use.
I think that's it. I think that's exactly it. And it gives a lot of those are good baselines for if you're trying to design a piece with ergonomics in mind. So I've done that where I'll take and modify a plan. I've done it where I've gone completely from scratch. That takes a lot more time. It's a little more difficult. And then I've also done it where, again, coming from completely from scratch, either doing a mock-up, a scale mock-up, either with cardboard or with plywood, or actually just designing the whole thing in SketchUp. Lately, I've been getting plans that I've found either online or through periodicals, and then modifying them to what I want them to look like. And the reason is because my time in the shop is very limited right now. So it just is a lot easier for me to go with a plan that I know has been well reviewed. A lot of times I'll look at the fine woodworking plans, and you're able to get those plans for relatively cheap, often with a coupon. But that's what I've been doing lately. I hope to eventually, once I get a little more time in the shop, to start trying to design my own things again. But Guy, how about you? What do you do?
A couple of years ago, I got this email from this guy named Ted.
Oh my goodness.
All 16,000 of them?
All 16,000 of them?
No, I got like 36,000.
Oh, you got the better deal.
If anybody out there listening, you get an email from a guy named Ted that's selling woodworking plans, don't. Anyways, I've done a little bit of everything over the years. And right now where I am is I want to say I build most of my stuff on the fly. I don't buy plans. I haven't bought plans for a couple years now. I will go into SketchUp just to get the rough dimensions. I don't do like the joinery and everything like that unless I really feel I need to or if it's something I'm uncomfortable building. But for the most part, it's just getting the rough sizes and things like that. And then the piece kind of takes a life of its own after I start building it because things change due to materials I have on hand. I really hate having to go somewhere to get some wood to make a part. I'll just use what I have in my scrap bin, and that can change all kinds of things. So I do a lot of it pretty much off the cuff. And a real good example is this cabinet I just posted a video on. That was totally based on the piece of wood I had. I was like, okay, I've got this one board. I want to make this. And I started laying out the parts and how I wanted to pull them from the board, and it just evolved. But I've built that same cabinet probably 15 or 20 times over the years. It, you know, the dimensions are a little bit different than the other ones I've made, but it's basically the same design.
That seems like a really great exercise of having that sort of constraint of just this singular board and just really designing it around that.
Yeah, I had a lot of fun with that project. I've never videotaped anything like that before because it's not something a lot of people do, I guess. But I had this one board, it was curly ash, and I wanted to build one thing out of the one board. It came out pretty nice. But the bottom line, I guess, is what I'm saying is do whatever you're comfortable with. If you're more comfortable with plans, you know, get some plans. And if they don't agree with you aesthetically or dimensionally, just change them around a little bit to get what you want. It'll take a lot of the guesswork out of it for you. How about you, Sean?
When I first started woodworking, primarily used existing woodworking plans. And then I wanted to dabble in SketchUp. And ever since then, I pretty much just design what I'm going to make, which slows me down being a nights and weekend woodworker. And depending on the complexity, that'll determine how far I take the design in SketchUp. But here recently, for my past, I don't know, 5 or 10 projects, I've pretty much designed the whole project, including joinery, in SketchUp, just to have in case I wanted to give the plans away to someone. And when I'm making my projects, I will reference existing plans all the time. There's no sense in, you know, recreating the wheel when, you know, they've got everything figured out as far as aesthetically pleasing dimensions and proportions and joinery figured out. So I will reference plans all the time just to see how they did it. And books like the Rodale's Illustrated Cabinet Making, it has, the book is filled with exploded diagrams of furniture showing construction methods and alternatives. And it also gives common sizes to things like table widths for the number of seats and table heights and the chairs like Hui was mentioning. So that's a fantastic book that I always reference along with plans. And the part he's asking, what do we routinely find difficult to design? And for me, that is the proportions, just making sure that it looks good in person like it does in SketchUp, because in 3D land, it looks a little different compared to real life land, I'm going to call it. Yeah. What looks okay in SketchUp can be too bulky in real life. So that's the chunky, difficult part for me. Exactly.
I have a really great example of where I kind of screwed up, not drastically, but I kind of screwed up a little bit in the design phase of my dining table, in that the stretcher is just about 2 inches too short for the chairs that I have going under. Now, they fit underneath the dining table perfectly fine, but where they are placed on the dining table is a little bit too close to each other relative to the chairs that are on the end. And literally, if it were just 2 inches longer, it would be perfect. And it was just one of those things that I designed that in SketchUp. I designed it. It's my own design. And I gained inspiration from just looking at pictures online and seeing things that I liked. But then again, I didn't have the chairs that were going to go with that dining table beforehand. And that was my screw up.
Yeah, and that's where that illustrated cabinet making is great, because it'll tell you how much space you need per chair, and it's a great reference. I use it all the time.
A lot of times I'll just grab the tape measure and come in the house and measure something.
Yeah.
How tall does this need to be? Well, how tall is the one I kind of have now?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's no shame in measuring existing pieces that are at stores or in your house. I mean,
yeah, you get odd look from, you know, people when you're lying on your back underneath a table that they're trying to sell. But I've been there and done that. So there's no shame in that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Well, all right, Guy, I think you've got the next question.
All right. This is from Wayne. And Wayne's saying, you know, love your podcast. Well, thank you, Wayne. He bought a Miter Express with 1,000, an Incra Miter Express with 1,000 HD. Just so everybody knows, that's like a cross-cut sled that you put a miter gauge into. It says, I know you are fans of Incra products. I love this product as a cross-cut sled, very accurate and repeatable. How do you set it up for angle cuts and cut with the same accuracy and repeatable cuts? The nice thing about that sled is the part that you put the miter gauge into, you actually make a cut all the way through the piece of wood, all the way through that when you first set it up. So what you have is a perfectly zero clearance cut to that line. And it's really easy to get your miter gauge in on that at a perfect 90 degrees, because you can just take a square, you know, like a 12-inch speed square, put that against the edge you just cut, and just butt your miter gauge fence right up to it and zero it out.
That's one of the reasons why I purchased it. I don't like hassling with crosscut sleds and the fences and shimming it and rescrewing it. That was amazing.
Yeah, that's all that five cut method is, well, that all that whole thing is just too anal for me. But with this, you can just get it perfect dead nuts on there. Once you have that set up, the 1000 HD has, I don't know, I think 30 million little indentations for different, I think it's got 180 indentations. It goes for every degree, and then it can go down to a tenth of a degree with the vernier scale. So it's very, very accurate. Once you've got it set up to that 90 degrees, if you put it at 22 and a half degrees, it's going to be at 22 and a half degrees. It's going to be perfect. As far as the repeatability goes, the 1000 HD, the stop that comes with it, it's a flip stop. And it also cannot be used up against the fence as it sits, but you can also screw a piece of MDF or sacrificial fence on it and then move the swing stop out a little bit so it covers that. So it can go either way, which is kind of nice. I always use a sacrificial fence on mine because then I can just make a tick mark of where I'm going to cut the first piece, line it up right to that cut in the sacrificial fence. And then I can set my flip stop, and then I get the repeatability that way.
And that flip stop has zero deflection.
Yeah, unlike the Craig one you have, Sean.
Oh, my God, dude. I can't tell you how many times I've wanted to smash that thing.
I had one of those on my miter saw station, and you had to be so gentle when you push the wood up against it.
Yeah. I don't know why I still use it. I mean, to be honest with you, but I do. But yeah, that's a great crosscut sled setup. The Incra 1000 HD setup. It's really nice. The way that you dial in the fence is what sold me on it. And the way that you can easily store it, it's a great setup. And I got it on sale. So that what really motivated me to buy it.
I thought you have a Miter Express.
Mm-hmm. I got it on sale.
I've never seen
it. $30 off. Yeah.
I always thought you had that shop made one with the Craig on it.
No, I've got, I still have the Craig and the shop made, but I also have the Incra.
Okay, I didn't know that.
Oh, it's amazing. I love it.
Yeah, it's heavy.
Yeah, but it's so easy to dial in. That's all I care about.
Yep.
I'm one of those silly people who still uses a crosscut sled.
Yours is no regular crosscut sled, though.
No, the thing is huge. It's like an aircraft carrier.
Yeah. With all of the options.
Well, that's what this is. It's a crosscut sled, Wee.
Yeah. No, I know.
It's got a 24-inch crosscut capacity.
It's really nice. It's very nice. Yeah.
The reason I went with it, as many of you know, I'm kind of in bed with Ankara. But besides that, I went through a lot of crosscut sleds in my day. I mean, a lot of crosscut sleds. They lose calibration. It's a pain to put them back into calibration. And they're just big and bulky is the biggest thing. I didn't have any place good to put it. I was always kicking it around. This is real nice because it's a very small footprint hanging on a wall or hanging on the side of a tool somewhere. It's just fantastic. I can't recommend it enough. I recently got the Miter 5000. Yeah.
Yeah.
Awesome. Just awesome.
That thing is big.
Yeah, it's a full size, but you have to consider it's still only half the size of something like yours.
True.
Because it's only to the left of the blade.
Right.
Or to the right of the blade. You don't have a piece going all the way across.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That was a short answer. I guess we can move on to the next question, and that would be for you, Sean. What do you got?
All right, this one's from Kingdom Concealment. Woodshop Life hosts, really enjoying the podcast as I'm just getting started, literally, with woodworking. Figured I'd ask all three of y'all a question on equipment. So, miter saws, and what do you recommend? 10-inch or 12-inch, sliding or non-sliding, single or dual bevel, Brand varies for each user, kind of like vehicles, but I'm looking at the DeWalt, Ridgid, and Bosch. Thank you for your time and keep up the excellent info with the podcast and social media. Appreciate that. I guess it depends on a few things, really. How much space do you have? If you're limited, you can see if the 12-inch sliding Bosch will fit because it's not going to need as much space as a traditional sliding miter saw. It'll fit in tighter spots as the arm doesn't need as much room. What are you going to be doing with it?
It's kind of a knuckle on the back, right?
Yeah. It
doesn't really slide.
Yes.
The Hitachi does the same thing. You can adjust the way the arm is set up so it doesn't need as much room. So that's one of the reasons why I got it, was it doesn't require a whole lot of room. What are you going to be doing with it? Are you going to be doing any trim work? If so, my vote is for the 12-inch sliding Bosch. Are you breaking down rough stock only? Again, it, you know, it depends on what kind of stock you're breaking down. The 12-inch slider will give you the capacity of over 12 inches. I know the Hitachi, I can't speak for these other three, the Hitachi will cut up to 12 3/4. There have been some complaints that the sliding miters aren't as stiff or as rigid and may flex a little. I mean, I don't use the miter saw for finished cuts, so that's not a huge concern for me, but although I've not really noticed it with the Hitachi, my vote is the 12-inch sliding Bosch. And if you have that, it's going to give you all the options you want and fit in a nice compact spot.
You said the crosscut capacity on your Hitachi is only 12.5 inches?
12 3/4.
12 3/4. Is that a 12-inch blade on that or a 10-inch blade?
Yes. Let me double check.
Is that a 12-inch blade?
Yes.
Okay.
Hold on a minute. I believe it is.
Okay.
Yeah, I believe it'll do 12 3/4, unless I'm just losing my mind, but...
Yeah, I'd say you're losing your mind. I really don't know. I have the Festool, and it's about 10 inches. We'll call it a 10-inch, and that does 12-inch crosscut. I would think the 12-inch blade would have more of a crosscut, but that's really going to give you a lot of extra depth.
Right.
I guess the question you really have to ask yourself on this whole thing is, what are you going to be using it for?
Yeah, exactly.
If you plan on making furniture quality crosscuts and miters, in my opinion, which we know what opinions are like, the only one I have ever used that makes that good of a cut is what I currently have, which is the Festool. I have not used the Bosch. I've heard very good things about it, but I have a Hitachi also. And I had a Makita before that, which is also very highly rated, but these were, you know, the Makita and the Festool are sliding compound miter saws. The problem I have with the sliding compound miter saws is what Sean mentioned, they flex. So if you put too much pressure on it going one way or the other, your cut's going to go out of whack, except for the Festool. It's the only one I've ever used that didn't do that. So if you're not making furniture ready cuts, and you're just doing rough cuts, I would just go with
trim work.
You know, trim work is not, if you're doing trim work, go with the 12 inch because it'll give you a higher depth when cutting cove molding.
Yep.
But if you're not going to be doing trim work, 10 inch is fine, and the blades are cheaper and there's more of them available out there. But if you're just making rough cuts, I would just go with probably a DeWalt or Ridgid, to be honest with you, because those are both very good saws. They're not going to be furniture quality cuts, but they will be good cuts, and they'll be close enough where you can dial it in with something else later on.
Mm-hmm.
That's my take on it.
So you're saying that none of those three would be furniture ready cuts?
I don't know about the Bosch. I've never used it.
I've owned the Bosch. I can speak to the Bosch and say that I was not confident enough to get furniture quality cuts off of the Bosch.
Are you confident with the Festool?
Yes.
100%?
Now, no, 100% confident with the Festool.
Yep.
Absolutely. Okay, now when you're saying furniture grade cuts, let's talk about that for a second. Are you meaning miters, or are you meaning a 90-degree edge for...
I can take a board over there. Here's how I cross cut things. If it's under 12 inches wide and it's over 16 inches long, I use my miter saw. If it's under 16 inches and over 12 inches wide, I'm going to use my miter saw or the miter gauge of the sled. And that has to do with the stops. Mm-hmm. I am as confident with my Festool miter saw as I am with my Incra miter gauge. If I set it at 90, it's going to be 90. There's no question about it. I don't have to worry about my how I'm holding my hand and how I pull the saw forward. It just cuts it at perfect 90. If I need to make a 22.5 degree cut, it's going to be 22.5. Perfect. Every time. It's not a roughing tool. It's a finish tool. Mm-hmm. So if you don't need that kind of accuracy, I would go with the Walter Rigid, because it's going to give you, both saws are going to give you a pretty decent cut.
If you have the room for it.
If you have the room for it.
I looked in the Hitachi cuts 12.25 on the width, 4 3/16 on the height.
Yeah. What do you think, Wee?
First off, the very first miter saw I had was a Delta chop saw, and that had like only a few detents, and then everything else, you kind of tap here and tap there to try to get it less than 45 degrees or greater than 23.5. I had the Bosch, I guess it's called an Axial Glide. Yeah, Axial Glide, that's what it was called. And it was a great saw. It was a good saw. The thing that I had issues with is when I got it, I only used it in chop saw mode. In other words, I never really had to expand it out because I was using it as a roughing tool for lumber most of the time. And since a lot of the pieces that I was cutting weren't extraordinarily long, I was doing all of my finish cuts on the crosscut sled or with a miter gauge on the table saw. What I realized is that when I was pulling out the saw, the knuckle drifted. And I didn't know that until I actually had to crosscut something that was longer than 12 inches and wider than, whatever the width for just chop saw mode was. Well, thankfully, it was still under warranty. I sent it back and they had to replace the entire knuckle because the blade was, while it was square, it was drifting. And it was the weirdest thing. Huh. Guy, I think I actually talked to you about this.
Yeah,
I talked to you about it. Thankfully, it was still under warranty. But after that, I never really trusted it. Like I just, you have something like that and then you've got, a nice piece of wood or whatever that's just perfectly beautiful straight grain that's going to be an apron for your table. And then you go to the miter saw and then you cut it and you're like, oh my goodness, it's not square. Yeah. See, I just didn't trust it after that. And they sent it back and they said everything was fine. Again, I just didn't trust it. And even after they fixed it, what I noticed is that when you pulled the saw out at the furthest point, if you are just very slightly pushing one way or the other, mm-hmm. you're going to deflect the saw. And yep. I have tested the Festool Capex over and over and over again, at least 5 times, and I do not get that deflection. Yeah, I don't get issue.
I guess you have to ask yourself this question, Sean. If you were making a picture frame and you wanted it to be perfectly square, do you trust your miter saw to go over to it and cut 45 degrees perfect?
No. I go straight to the table saw for anything other than breaking down rough stock. I don't even use my miter saw.
See, I use my miter. If I was making a picture frame, I would have absolutely no problem going over to my Capex and doing it because I know it's going to be perfect.
It's expensive as all get out.
Yeah.
Oh my God. It's insanely expensive.
Yes.
It is insanely expensive. It should not be that expensive. That being said, it's the only saw I've ever used that makes furniture-ready, perfect cuts 100% of the time.
So out of those three, since he's just literally getting started, I don't know if he has the Festool in his budget or not. Out of those
Nobody
three, depending
the
on the size and how much.
Budget.
Yeah.
Well, I said I couldn't speak to the Bosch. Yeah. Out of the three, I'd say look at the Bosch. I've heard very good things about the Bosch.
Yeah. It's a good saw. It is a good saw. Yeah. It's a great saw. It's just, with my experience, and you got to remember that not everything that comes from a manufacturer is perfect. Even though Bosch is a great brand and it's a great saw, every now and then
you get a lemon.
You get a lemon. So don't just take my experience as the experience that you're going to have, And the thing is that Bosch is a great brand and it's a great name. And I called their customer service and they paid for the shipping. They shipped it back. They fixed it. It was under warranty, not an issue. Not an issue at all.
You bought it used or reconditioned, didn't you?
I bought it reconditioned from an authorized dealer.
Yeah.
And so it still had a warranty under it.
So my opinion of the matter is, as far as what I use the miter saw, I mean, I've paid decent money for my table saw and it's dialed in and I've got it, you know, the Incra and this and that. I mean, I would rather use that than my miter saw. So I don't feel like that I would want to spend that kind of money for a miter saw when I've got, you know, the table saw. That's my feeling on the matter as far as why I have the Hitachi and use the table saw primarily for almost all cuts.
I think that's a great strategy.
Yeah, my goal is to eventually get rid of the miter saw and reclaim that space, but we'll see. I keep saying that every time.
You'll keep it. It's a good tool to have, you know, for just breaking down lumber and stuff. It's a good tool to have.
Yeah, for sure. All right, so who you're next? What you got for us?
All right, this is from Paul Getz. Great guy, I know him. I follow all of you on Instagram and YouTube. Thank you, guy. Thank you, Paul. Thank you for creating the podcast and for putting your content and knowledge out there. It's great for me to learn. My wife and I are expecting a baby boy in April. Family is my top priority, and I always value shop time and working out, all of which my wife is very supportive of. I know I will need to be more efficient in the shop and may need to break things down into smaller steps. Hui, I know you. This is something you are experiencing now with a new baby. I'd love to hear how you all balance your shop time with other life priorities and how you make the most of the sometimes limited time that you have in the shop. Thank you, guys, and keep up the great work. Thank you for the question, Paul. So I'm in pretty much the situation that Paul's going to be in. My wife and I just had our little girl, Eleanor Claire Huynh. And shop time's very limited for me right now. But I do the best that I can by just taking on exactly what you said, Paul, taking on smaller steps. For instance, just laying something out. If I only have an hour, by no means am I going to start a glue up. Like, I'm just not going to do that. Because I know that I might be able to finish it in an hour. And if I don't, well, then I'm really screwed because I've got glue all over the joints and whatnot. And I'm just not going to be able to finish it. And then it's a huge mess. So just understanding your processes first is a really big thing. And knowing whatever the amount of time that's needed for that process, just double it. You know, if you think that it's going to take you a half an hour to lay out all the mortises on a piece, allocate an hour. Because the last thing I want to do is tell my wife it's going to take me a half an hour to do something. And then I'm in the middle of it and I'm upset because now I'm in the middle of doing it and the half an hour has already passed. And I've told my wife that it's only going to take a half an hour. We're about to go see family and have dinner. I've done that before and I've learned my lesson. However long something takes, just double it. It's a good rule of thumb. Just the same as Paul, I like to work out. I like to spend a lot of time with family. Just realizing that the shop time's going to come around, you know, that project's going to be there. And when you get around to it, And also, it's good to communicate with your spouse to make sure that ahead of time, you know, I'll tell my wife, I'm going to take 2 hours here. Is it okay that I get that uninterrupted? And usually it's okay. And if it's not, then we allocate a different time for that. But that's how I go about it. You know, I also have a full-time job. And so that's not at all very easy either. But most of the time, it's during the week, I'm lucky if I get 2 hours. So that's pretty much it. On the weekends, I have a lot more time out there. That's not always the case either, because on the weekends, sometimes we're visiting family or doing something with the baby, or sometimes I just don't, on the weekends, sometimes I just don't feel like being out in the shop because I just got done mowing the lawn and, you know, it's 100% humidity and 99 degrees out in Alabama. So take it in stride and you'll get shop time out there. Guy, I know that you got kids out of the house and all your kids are grown up and whatnot.
Thank the Lord.
But what do you do? I know it's a little bit different now, but in the past, how have you dealt with it? And maybe how do you deal with it now?
When I was working full time, I primarily did it on the weekends. After I got the stuff that I got done, had to do that my wife had asked me to do, and it's stuff that needs to be done, you know, work around the house, you know, owning a house, there's a lot of upkeep. I don't have a children anymore, but I do have a house to upkeep and I've got a dog and a wife. So in that order is the order of importance, house, dog, wife. Just kidding. I found that the best way to do it to keep sanity, especially with your wife, is that if, you know, let's say you're planning on being in the shop all day, Sarah just says, I want to go here. Do yourself a favor and just say, okay, and go with her. Anytime my wife asks me to do anything, I pretty much just say, okay, now. I have a lot more time on my hands than most people do. I wouldn't say time on my hands, but I can pretty much make my schedule. So if she asked me to do something, I just say, okay, and I just do it. And that's the end of it. And I think because of that, she's a lot more lenient with what I need to get done. She knows if I'm busy, she won't come and ask me to do something else, if that makes sense. So it's just a little give and take more than anything else.
Yeah, you make a really good point, Guy. Whenever my wife asks me to do something, I mean, I just do it. I just do it because I know it's going to make her happy. And that's my number one job, is to make her happy. And yeah. And because of that, she's also very lenient on the weekends. You know, if I tell her ahead of time, hey, I'd really like to spend about 3 hours, knowing that it's going to take an hour and a half, or thinking that it's going to take an hour and a half, I'd like 3 hours out in the shop. And she's like, yeah, no, not a problem.
Yeah. And it's not like that, you know, my wife rules the house, because she doesn't. It's a partnership.
Absolutely.
It's just mutual. It's just showing mutual respect more than it is anything else. And that's what it's all about. If she says we have a family thing to do, I'm like, all right, it's just, okay. It just doesn't faze me anymore. Unless she wants me to rip walls out, then I
pay someone.
No, then I put it off because I don't like to do it. And that's where I am right now. I've got walls to rip out.
Ooh.
Yeah. Yeah. She gave me a big list of stuff to do, and I've been slowly grabbing the low hanging fruit off that list. Now I'm into the rip the walls out and rebuild the kitchen. We're actually going to be doing that after the holidays, because I put it off long enough where it's going to start getting into that. So I guess I got lucky. How about you, Sean?
The only thing that I can add that you guys haven't covered yet is, obviously with a baby coming, don't go into the shop and do much if you're tired. Most of the issues that I've had, whether it be mess up on a glue up or do something just stupid, is when I was tired in the shop. So if you're tired, don't do anything in the shop that'll screw up a project or hurt yourself. Wait until you've got some rest. That's about the only thing that I can add to this conversation.
No, it's good advice. It's good advice.
Yeah, very good advice.
All right, Guy, I think you got the next question.
All right. This comes from Paul Gustafson, and he's asking, I'm doing some veneer work lately, and I've heard that contact cement isn't the best adhesive. Although I am using the paperback veneer, I've had decent success with it. What do you recommend? The panels are about 24 by 24. I'm assuming that's inches. And I do not have a vac bag. Well, that just ruins everything, doesn't it? That was going to be the answer to the question, just get a vac bag. That's actually a really good question, Paul. Contact cement is not the best adhesive to use, especially when using commercial veneer that's around a 32nd to a 42nd of an inch thick. I've heard people have had success with it using the paperback veneers, but the problem with the paperback veneers is it doesn't really give you the choices. It's not like if you want to get some rosewood veneer, you're going to find it in paperback veneer. I could be wrong on that, but I don't think I've ever seen any. I know people that have had luck with the heat lock veneers. I've used it one time and the results were okay, but I found it to be very finicky. I was getting a lot of bubbles and stuff like that. It took a lot longer to do than I would have liked. What I had done for years before I got a vac bag was I used large melamine cauls. Melamine is basically chipboard with a plastic covering over the top of it. It's almost like plastic laminate, but much thinner. It's like some kind of paper that there's like an epoxy impregnated into it. Very cheap. I just looking at prices the other day. I was at Home Depot yesterday, as a matter of fact. A 4x8 sheet of it was $23. So it's very inexpensive. Make two calls out of it, one for the lower and one for the upper, and then make some cross calls. And I still have them. I've got a whole pile of them in my shop. What it is, it's just a 2x4 that I cut in half long ways. So they're roughly, you know, 2x2s. And then I went over on the joiner and I started in the middle of the 2x2 and did one half, flipped it around, and flipped the other half. So it kind of like comes to a point in the center, but it's about a 32nd or to a 16th of an inch less on each end.
Mm-hmm.
You put that in the center and then you put clamps on, you put one underneath and one on top, and then you clamp it from the edges. And what that'll do is give you even pressure all the way across. it works really well. Like I said, I used that process for years, probably close to 10 years I did it that way. And I did some very large glow-ups. I did a couple dining room tables like that that were, you know, 6 feet long, 40-some inches wide. That's my best advice if you're not willing to go out and get a vac bag. Vac bags are not that expensive. My first one, I think I paid $100 for the bag. I used a system that I got from veneersupplies.com that was used in conjunction with my air compressor. I think out of pocket, all said and done, was about $200 and some. And it worked well. It just didn't evacuate the air very quickly. And that was a 4x4 bag. And I said it worked really, it works really well and was cheap. And then I upgraded to, I rebuilt that and bought a reconditioned motor. And so I put about another $200 into it. And then I sold that to you, Sean.
Yeah, and I love it.
Yeah, it worked. That was a great little pump. And then I got an opportunity to work with VacuPress. And I've got one of their, you know, professional model vac pumps, which is a really expensive thing, but it's awesome. I'd recommend using calls like I just described. Have you ever done anything like that, guys? Sean?
Yeah, I have. Smaller panels using the calls, but I've also used the heat lock veneer glue where you put it on the substrate, put it on the veneer, let them both dry, and then you use an iron. Once you place the veneer on top of the substrate, the iron locks it into place. And I use it on a couple of projects, and I really liked it. It's easy, especially if you're doing 24x24 flat surfaces. There's nothing too crazy. That's not a huge panel, but it's a decent sized panel. So heat lock worked well for me. And like I was saying with the calls, I've done both of those.
When I started veneering, it was purely a vacuum bag and a vacuum pump from VacuPress. And the reason is because after doing the math, the VacuPress was actually offering some more consumer-based model pumps that were a little bit more affordable. And so I actually got one of those. And with the bag, it actually came out to close to what the price would be if I were to build it myself. The only thing, I didn't have to build it myself. So I went that route, and it saved me a little bit of time in the shop. And I really like having a vacuum bag because you don't only have the ability to do veneering, you can also do bent lamination. And that's cool. I really enjoy bent lamination. I really enjoy doing curvilinear work. And I knew that eventually I wanted to go that route. And I know you can do bent lamination without a vacuum bag, but I knew that would be the eventual route that I'd want to take. So I went with the vacuum bag right off the bat.
Yeah, another thing you can use, a vacuum bag is like really super handy. When I built my bench and I was laminating the legs together to get, you know, basically 4x4s out of ash, I used my vacuum bag to laminate them together.
You didn't use 100 clamps?
No, I did not use 100 clamps.
Oh, man.
And it worked really well. And when I built my clock and I needed to get some thicker built-up mahogany, that's what I used. I used a vacuum bag. I find uses for it all the time, especially the vac pump, as far as vacuum clamps go. And those can be shop made. You don't have to buy the little aluminum pucks. I think we've talked about that before.
But yeah, it's handy to own the vacuum pump and the bag because of all of these different things you can do with it.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. But there are ways that, I mean, like I said, before I bought that, I wasn't, you know, and on my bent laminations, I still don't use the bag that much just because I'm used to doing it the old way, I guess. Anyways, like I said, calls are a great way to do it if you don't have a bag. Who's got the next question? Sean, you have the last question?
Yeah.
What? Pray tell, is it?
This one is from Logan Gross, and he says, General Finishes has been my go-to finish ever since I quit using Minwax polyurethane. I would like to try other finishes, linseed oil, shellac, waterlocks, but I'm curious as to how well they will protect projects compared to General Finishes. Obviously, it depends on what you're finishing. I would like to hear all your pros and cons for different finishes. Thanks so much. Love the podcast.
Wow, that's a question that would take like 3 hours to answer.
I bet I can answer it in less than 3 minutes. How about that?
I can answer it in two.
Well,
it's an entire show, really, but
yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Well, it's just quickly, answer it. So he mentions linseed oil. Boiled linseed oil is the least protective from the list that he's mentioned. I mainly use it for changing the appearance of the wood, and I primarily use it on cherry to help darken it a little bit before I'll place some top coat over it, whether that be a shellac or a wiping varnish. But a boiled linseed oil is a soft, thinner finish, so it doesn't really provide a significant barrier against scratching. And it's also easily penetrated by water and, of course, water vapor. So I mainly use it for tinting the wood, changing the appearance, ambering it up a little bit. The Minwax, the Wipe-On Poly, the Armor Seal, and the Water Locks are all your wiping varnishes. With enough coats, they're going to give you great protection. The key is with enough coats because they are a thinner finish, but enough coats, you'll have a nice protective finish on the surface. The varnishes contain a resin, which will help build a protective layer on the project. And then I would rank shellac in between the boiled linseed oil. I don't know why I can't say that. I want to keep calling it BLO. And the wiping varnish, it's going to have way more, it's going to be way more protective than a BLO, a linseed oil. But shellac has a weak resistance to heat and water and things like alcohol. And I primarily use shellac on projects like cabinetry and other items that won't see a whole lot of abuse. The good thing about shellac for projects like wall cabinets is you won't have to really worry about the smell like you would from a wiping varnish since it's an oil-based finish. So the shellac will make a piece look awesome, add some protection, and not smell. And D-Wax shellac is great for coloring woods because you've got colors ranging from super blonde to garnet. So you can put that on the surface to tone the wood a little bit and then top coat that with a wiping varnish. But in a nutshell, that's my take on the three different types of finishes that you mentioned. Was that under 3 minutes?
Yes. So, I don't know. I wasn't timing. I guess the question you really have to ask yourself is, what are you putting the finish on? If you're putting on a tabletop, like a kitchen table, that's one thing. If you're putting it on the top for a nightstand, that's another thing. If you're putting on a wall cabinet, that's another thing. I've used just about every finish under the sun. And, you know, the Minwax polyurethane is fine. I used to use that all the time. And I still do if I'm in a pinch because it's readily available. I think you can only get it at Lowe's now. I don't think Home Depot. I think Home Depot has a exclusive with Varathane.
I think
Minwax
you're right.
Minwax has a, yeah. An exclusive with Lowe's. I may be incorrect. Anyways, what I used to do for years, this is going back again, you know, way in the dark days, I made my own wiping varnish, and it was a three-parter. It was a third Minwax polyurethane, a third boiled linseed oil, and a third naphtha. Basically, I made my own wiping varnish. That's what General Finish's Armor Seal is. Now, you're saying General Finish is my go-to finish. I'm assuming you're talking about Armor Seal, which is a wiping varnish. It works really well. I never used to like the Armor Seal, and now I'm using it a lot more whenever I'm putting a hand-applied finish on, if I'm not using just straight shellac. It's a very high quality. The Minwax is just as good. I don't know why Minwax gets such a bad name. Maybe because it is something you can buy at Lowe's. I don't know. But the Minwax product, the polyurethane is fine. There's absolutely nothing wrong with it. Waterlocks is a different animal. That's a wiping varnish also, but it's more tung oil than it is linseed oil. And there's also other polymers and resins in it. I don't know what their formula is. I think it's a closely kept secret. That can be, if you put too many coats of that on, that can build up a film finish and give you a plasticky look. While the something like an Armor Seal or a wiping varnish, you'd have to put a ton of it on there to achieve that. So I like the wiping varnishes because it gives you a good amount of protection, and it's basically idiot-proof. You wipe it on and you wipe it off. Shellac I use a lot of. I really like shellac, but you have to play with it and you have to use it a while to really find a way that works for you. It's kind of like sharpening a card scraper. Everybody's got a different way of doing it and they all work well. Applying shellac is kind of the same way. I'm sure all three of us have different ways of applying shellac, and that just comes with trial and error.
And with shellac, one of the things you're going to run into if you've never used it is streaking, because it dries so fast if you apply it with a cotton cloth or something.
Yeah, especially if you're using a really thin cut, like a pound or a pound and a half cut, like I use most of the time. It dries mm-hmm. almost instantly.
Yeah, you've got to lay it down and move on. Don't play with it.
Well, how about you, Hui?
My go-to, and it's because the application is so easy, is something like an armor seal, or just like you, Guy, I've mixed my own wiping varnish as well, because it's easy. And my wiping varnish has always been Minwax. It's just always been Minwax because it's just readily available. And I completely agree. I don't know why Minwax gets such a bad name. It's polyurethane.
Yeah.
It's liquefied plastic. That's what it is.
Well, there's just people that just want to badmouth it because you buy that at Lowe's. I buy mine at Woodcraft and pay more for it, so mine's better.
I've heard people say that the resins that they use in Armor Seal are better than the Minwax and whatnot. One pro with the Armor Seal over the Minwax wipe-on poly, that is, they don't sell a semi-gloss, do they? They only sell a satin and a gloss, right?
I don't know. I don't use anything but satin for the most part.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm going to backtrack on that. I use satin and gloss. The first couple coats I put on are the gloss, and then the last couple coats I put on are the satin.
What does that do?
There was a time before, you know, we started all using these wiping varnishes where you would just use straight polyurethane, and you might put 2 to 3 coats of it on. You'd use the gloss because there was the school of thought was that it was clearer than the satin.
Okay.
So you'd put it on there and it wouldn't muddy the finish, and then you'd put the last coat of satin on it. I've used because of that, I have gloss in my shop, in my finishing cabinet, and I still use it. And you can always rub that out too with steel wool and wax. You finish the finish.
Yeah, yeah. I guess what I was just saying is, if you were going for a semi-gloss, it's less work than having to rub out a finish. But you should probably be, unless it's a pristine, dust-free finish, you're going to be rubbing it out anyways.
I mean, I myself, I don't like gloss or semi-gloss. If it was up to me, everything would have a satin finish.
I like a little bit more sheen than a satin. I like a semi-gloss.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's each his own.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I've been experimenting a little bit with some water-based products. Water-based lacquers, which I think, you know, and I don't know this for sure, but I think it's pretty much the same thing as like General Finish's top coat, but I don't know the answer to that.
Those are still water white though.
Yeah. Yeah, they are. They are.
The clear ones, water white, which basically means it doesn't impart any color to it.
Right.
General Finish's has a water-based product, Endurovar, that I used, and it really didn't thrill me too much. I like water-based poly, mm-hmm. but I put it on like my shop cabinets, which was using maple plywood, and I wanted it water white. I didn't want to impart any color to it. I've done it on the inside of cabinets before.
I've used the water-based products after using a tinted dewax shellac to impart some color, like a garnet. And then put the water-based top coat over it. And that seemed to, well, I mean, I'm sitting at a desk that has it right now, and it's holding up pretty good. But they're relatively easy to use because they clean up with water. And
they don't stink.
They don't stink. They spray really nice. They spray really nice.
Yeah, the spray is really nice. It lays nice and flat.
Yeah, yeah. And I've been spraying a lot more, so...
Yeah, I'm the only one out of the three of us that doesn't spray. And when I applied the Endurovar, I brushed it, and I could, no matter what I did, I just could not get that stuff to not have brush marks. The Endurovar, I don't know what it is about that stuff, but
well, man. Water-based poly, you're supposed to use a sponge applicator. It should be using a sponge brush or a sponge roller. Don't use a regular brush. It says it right on there. Use a sponge.
A foam brush?
Yep.
Yeah, and that's what I used with the Endurovar. It's still...
Really?
Yeah, I've had zero luck with Endurovar.
Yeah. I got some... That's what I put on the Murphy bed I built.
It sprays really well from what I hear.
Yeah, it sprayed well. It just didn't thrill me too much. It was okay. It was okay. I've used the General Finishes. I think they call it, I don't know what they call it.
High Performance.
High Performance, yeah. Mm. And that was pretty good. I've used the Minwax polycrylic and had good luck with that. But most of the time I'm putting down, I know it sounds crazy, it's a three-step process, but I'll put boiled linseed oil on it. I never put straight boiled linseed oil on anything. I cut it 50-50 with naphtha. So that's just me. I'll put boiled linseed oil and naphtha on it, let it sit for a few days, put a coat of shellac on it to seal it, and then put the water-based poly on top of that.
Yeah.
If I'm going to spray. Then I get my color. You know, you get that amber look that's very desirable, especially on something like walnut or cherry. And then the polyurethane, the water-based polyurethane is nice because it dries really fast and it dries very flat and it's easy to sand back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's one thing I wanted to mention about shellac. Even though it may not be the most protective finish, it's still great to learn how to use it for things like Guy said. You know, he puts it over top of the BLO before he puts on the water-based top coat. It's a great thing to use all the time is the D-Wax shellac for more than just as a top coat.
As my friend Freddie Roman says, shellac will stick to anything and anything will stick to shellac.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So it's worth learning.
Yes.
Yep. Yep. Take the time.
Just one question. Do you guys, I only use D-Wax. What about you guys?
I've only used D-Wax.
I've used both.
What do you primarily use though? I mean, I've used both, but I
primarily buy flakes.
Yeah.
And mix my own. And I mix anywhere from a pound to 2 pound cuts. Most of the time I'm using pound and a half. If I'm in a hurry, which, you know, shellac goes on so darn fast. But if I'm in a hurry, I'll do one coat of a 2 pound cut, sand it back, and then the subsequent coats are pound and a half cuts. If I'm not in too big of a hurry and I want to save, you know, a whole 15, 20 minutes, I'll go and put, you know, two coats of the pound and a half and then sand back and then start applying other coats of shellac.
So a good shellac to get started with is the Zinsser, what is it called? Seal coat?
Seal coat.
Yep. Yeah. You can use that. You can even thin it a little bit with denatured alcohol to get started and experiment with that. And then once you graduate from that, start mixing your own flakes and you have a wide variety of colors that you can get.
Yeah, the big advantage for me to using shellac is, let's say I'm working on like a box or something like that, or even like I said, this wall cabinet I just finished. The finishing only takes a day.
Yeah,
I can put multiple coats of shellac on, and you know, you put a coat of shellac on, you let it dry for 15, 20 minutes, and if it's not cold to the touch anymore, it's dry. Sand it back, put another coat on, wait 15, 20 minutes, sand it back, put another coat on. And it can go pretty quick.
Yeah. If you don't need a bomb-proof finish for something like a dining table, definitely look at shellac. It's fast and it'll do the job.
Yeah. I use a lot of shellac. Again, this conversation can go on forever.
Absolutely. But yeah, I think this covered it pretty well.
Yeah.
I think that'll do it for this show. Please remember that this podcast is here to answer the questions from the woodworking community. So if you have questions for us that you'd like answered, you can send them through the podcast contact page at woodshoplifepodcast.com. Or don't forget, you can DM us through Instagram at woodshoplife. We would also like to thank everyone who left us a 5-star review on iTunes. It really helps us in the search rankings. And of course, we truly appreciate the support and feedback. You can reach me at simplecove.com and at simplecove on Instagram and YouTube. Where can you be found?
You can find me at alabamawoodworker.com, and all my links to my social media should be there. Guy, where can we find you?
I can be found at guyswoodshop.com.
Awesome. Thanks for listening, everyone. We'll see you in a couple weeks.
See you guys.
Later, dudes.